Welcome to the Out of the Woods podcast, the top five headlines threat hunters need to be thinking of this week.
Hey everyone, welcome to another edition of the Out of the Woods Threat Hunting Podcast. This is Scott Poley here with Lee Arkinall.
Thanks for joining us, everyone.
And this weekly segment features the top five stories that threat hunters need to be thinking about, as well as our thoughts on the subject and hunting strategies. So with that, let's dive into the top five threat hunting headlines for the week of March 18th, 2024. So the one thing, I know there's a lot of reports that are circling around this that time of year, because I think you grab one and I grab one, but I'll kick off with one of the ones I was looking at earlier. And it's from IBM's X-Force group, their Threat Intelligence Index of 2024. And there are some interesting call-outs that, you know, I think are of note. One, they kind of start off in the report looking at different, like, percentage increases of things like that. And one of the things that I thought was interesting was of all the things they investigated, they said there's 84% initial access vector that were leveraged could have been mitigated. And what does that mean, right? It means they could have been, there are patches in place that would have prevented the initial access. If the credentials were hardened, as they put it, I'm guessing they're referring to like a two-factor approach, that too would have prevented it. And then least principle, where obviously you have people that maybe have credentials that are used to externally connect in that also have privileges to do other things within the environment, that could have restricted what that meant for that initial access. So it seems like that was kind of an interesting number, knowing that a lot of that remote connectivity we always hear about people getting access to could have, through best practice essentially, been managed better. The other thing that stood out to me was they had a big call for upsurge in info stealers. And I think that's interesting because they said there was a 266% upsurge with the info stealers. And I think that's an interesting piece of information because they also said that 71% increase in attacks with valid credentials. I'm wondering, we're starting to see a lot more attacks where actually valid accounts are being leveraged. Versus someone figuring out other ways to skirt controls and gain access that way. So that's a notable thing where maybe info stealers is kind of becoming a dominant way to collect information and sell it. People are more interested in it, more reliable way to get access. And then the other was, you know, not a surprise, and I'm surprised this number is actually as low as it is, but they said there's a 32% where legitimate tools were used maliciously. I don't know how they calculate what that is or how that looks, but that was interesting. So, you know, some of those percentage things stood out in the beginning, but there were some graphs that I thought were interesting too. They were comparing year to year with initial access vectors, like I mentioned before, and you could see the rise in valid account access. It almost doubled, but you saw a pretty significant drop from phishing. You know, phishing used to be the way people would either harvest credentials or gain access. And it seems like that actually fell and is about, you know, equal mark with people using valid accounts. Then it kind of tails off through, you know, exploiting public facing stuff, external remote services, replication through media, drive by or trust relationships. It really tails off. But the one thing that I don't think was really accounted for, which would have been interesting, is those percentages for initial access don't really cover overall impact. And I think that's important to note because, you know, I only said like there's a 3% of initial accesses were through a trusted relationship, but trusted relationship gains a lot of impact, a lot of access, which overall could lead to a lot of impact. So I think that's something when you look at initial access vectors to be cognizant of, because sometimes maybe something's easy to access or gain access to, but the impact will be very minimal. So the risk doesn't calculate the same way. And there's two other main graphic visuals they called out. That I really liked, and that was they said the percentage of client environments with critical CVEs or CVEs with known exploits. And this is interesting because just how many of the clients they were looking at had this as a problem, because I know most vulnerability management programs are usually pretty good about prioritizing critical CVEs, maybe not so much pulling into if there's known exploits or looking for known exploits to prioritize those other CVEs. But they had something on, you know, the lowest percentage out of the customers was 25%. And those were customers with five or more critical CVEs in their environment. But 67% had at least one or more. And then with the known exploits, CVE with known exploits, almost 100%. So 92% actually had a CVE with a known exploit. Now, maybe it wasn't a critical one, so that's why it was able to exist that way. But then you had 81%, which is still higher than the ones with critical CVEs with the known exploit. And those are obviously important to handle. But the one thing that I think would have been a good skew to include in this data set was what was public facing and not. Because I do know that sometimes our mitigation strategies are in this program's mitigation strategies that are acceptable really pertain to where do these devices and things sit. So that's kind of an important note, right? If you have something that's really isolated or couldn't impact things adjacent to it, holding on to a critical CVE or something that's exploitable may be justifiable depending on your business. But that wasn't necessarily called out. And then the other thing was they actually were tracking ransomware and the dwell time. And what was interesting, within the past 3 years, ransomware's dwell time is just shy of 4 days. And that's interesting to see it hold for that long, because I think the year prior was in like the 1,000-hour mark as far how long they dwelled. So what that says to me when I look at that data, which was interesting in the report, was if you have a standard SOP, I expect those timelines to be consistent. And I feel like that's how ransomware operators operate to begin with. They're not really deviating from the script too much. They have their standard tool sets. They know what works. They know what processes to follow through. They've, you know, rinse and repeat, and they've had kind of like that repetition. And so now it's just a matter of get the job done. And so their dwell time is relatively consistent now, where it's roughly about 4 days in the past 3 years to be successful, if they can be successful. So those are like the highlights I wanted to pull out of that. I didn't know what your thoughts were, Lee, or if what I said made you think about anything different.
So I think that I think our eyes kind of went to the same numbers that were the 266% uptick of info stealers shocked me, but that kind of made sense of the other numbers that were around it. You know, the initial access was now, like for the first time in forever, I don't know, since they've been keeping this, it seems that phishing was not the number one initial access. Cause right. Why do you need someone to click on a link if you already have their credentials? But that just shocked me that I know there was like, I know info or the data shows that info steals are being used more, but this really shows that they're being used effectively, which
that's
is
true. Yeah.
Worrisome. And I think you nailed it on the head too about the trust relationship, because yes, there's, we're talking about what page is this, page 8, the top initial access vectors graph. I kind of feel like you could split the numbers up, or you could kind of organize this by almost like the sophistication of the group. While, you know, and I know we use the word sophisticated in cybersecurity a lot, which could mean a state-sponsored entity or a 16-year-old that is just beating someone up for their multi-factor authentication code. But if you look at the stuff that they're using, I really feel like that trusted relationship being so small would be like almost your sophisticated groups who are going to try and bide their time, learn who you are before they even attack you, learn what organizations you do business with, and see if there is access to that. I feel like they would use phishing and they would use valid accounts if possible to get into the supply chain. And then that's how they got into your environment. So I feel that even though, like, I know you said that trust relationship has a higher risk, which is absolutely true. But I feel like it all flows together, that the sophisticated
Well,
actors
something.
might just use the novel, or not the novel, but like the basic techniques on an organization's supply chain so that they can eventually get into their end goal using the trusted relationships.
Well, you made me kind of think when you started talking about sophisticated actors, that exploit of trust relationships, IBM's doing a sample of the customers or people they can see. But if you have compromised a trust relationship, there's probably a lot of other access being had that they're taking advantage of people outside IBM's purview too, right? Because that's the goal of exploiting someone that you potentially can leverage on multiple entities for trust. So, yeah, sophistication, I think that's a good cue for looking at that overall risk as well, like how big that could be.
And I think a number that I'm not surprised about was the 84% of critical infrastructure incidents where initial access vectors could have been mitigated. I know you discussed that well, but I feel like we are still fighting that battle to
Well,
get.
sometimes we like focus on like what we think is sexy as far as in the security field, like, ooh, this really complicated, like, well, look what they did. How do we stop something so complex? And it's like, guys, like you get more bang for your buck focusing on the simple things and the complex stuff. Hopefully you have time to respond or react to, in some light. So yeah, a lot of stuff, I just feel it's surprising it gets overlooked.
It's surprising that they don't, that we can't get the low-hanging fruit right. You know what I mean? The fact that the adversaries keep being successful by targeting the low-hanging fruit. Like that, I feel like we're just way past that with all the tools that we have. And I guess even though we have all these tools and we have all these nice shiny gadgets and stuff, it all boils down to the effectiveness of your process internally versus whatever easy button you think you bought.
Right.
Oh, actually, I did have a question for you, actually.
Okay.
So
Oh boy.
phishing is kind of seeing this, this report's kind of telling us that phishing is now, or info stealers is now even with phishing. And I'm going to just ask you for 2024, is this data going to change? And if it does, what do you think the new initial access vector will be?
I think phishing is always going to be there. I think one of the influences to why the phishing number is dropping doesn't have so much to do with its success rate or have to do with our controls and visibility to phishing. I think it actually has more to do with, I don't know if you're familiar, but like Google, for instance, was cracking down. And if someone hasn't logged into a Gmail account or their Google account in over 2 years, they're just going to delete it. So I think a lot of the infrastructure or the public infrastructure that's being leveraged a lot of times from compromised accounts and things, or I think there's just a bigger crackdown on some of the key infrastructure pieces that kind of allow for phishing in bulk to happen. And it might be kind of a stretch, but I like to think that's possibly why. And I don't know. Maybe it, it's what's weird to me though is seeing the phishing number drop, and yet the fear factor of, hey, now that we have AI, look how easy it is to social engineer. It's like, well, that's weird. And why isn't phishing going up? Right. So I don't know. I think there's a lot of things at play that kind of are kind of hard to account for. but are interesting ideas based on what people have been talking about, and that number being lower than expected. But I think fishing will still be there. I think the numbers are pretty telling. It's pretty much split 30-30-30 almost between ballot accounts, fishing, and exploiting public-facing applications. I think with the adversaries' tool sets and knowledge that we see today, as well as how well social engineering works, I think what's interesting to me is I've just actually been started reading the Kevin Mitnick book, Ghosts on the Wire. And he was like, you know, a world-renowned hacker. But when you just read about how he got into so many systems, almost none of it had to do with technical things. It was just calling and talking to people and getting access, you know, that way. It's just purely social engineering, before it was really considered that at the time, right? So, yeah, I feel like that's never going to go away. But as far as the split goes, I think 30-30-30 is pretty much a good split.
I guess now only time will tell.
Right.
Excited to see where it goes.
So what do you got?
So in the same vein, I have another year-end report. This time it's by Red Canary, the 2024 Threat Detection Report. Ironically, if you click on the link and you go check it out, it says download an abridged or the abridged report. And maybe it's my misunderstanding, but it's 162 pages long. I thought for it.
Yeah, I was kind of curious too.
Like, then let me see the full report. What's that look like? But either way, so to save you a lot of time, really what I was focused on, what really caught my eye was the techniques. You know, I'm a big fan of MITRE, love the tactics, techniques, sub techniques, love finding different ways to hunt for them. And if you go to page 90, it talks about them, and then it gives you the 2023 ranking. Now, not to be surprised, but PowerShell, Windows Command Shell, and Windows Management Instrumentation, or WMI, all are 1, 2, 3. They have been back in 22. PowerShell was number 2, and Windows Command Shell was number 1. WMI was still 3. And they all... they all fall under the idea of execution. What really caught my eye, and I think I don't think it's ironic. I have a feeling there's a strong correlation. But there is two techniques that made huge jumps. One is cloud accounts, technique 1078.004. Which is actually, the full name of it is Valid Accounts, Cloud Accounts. And that jumped up 42 spots, up all the way up to number 4. I found this ironic because of the discussion that we just had, where Valid Accounts are now becoming a big part of initial access. You know, things like Amazon Web Services or AWS, Microsoft Azure, Google Cloud, whatever else is out there. And I feel like this was all, it had to do with everyone rushing to the cloud, but no one being either patient enough or knowledgeable enough to properly secure it. So, you know, we all thought it was something easy, something like, whether it took off, saved a bunch of money, or took a load off our on-prem servers, whatever the case may be. I think we just went there, but no one really thought about how to secure it. And then, you know, SSO came along, where it's like, all right, you're tired of signing in everywhere, let's do SSO, but we'll turn on multi-factor authentication. We'll enable that. Hopefully, that it was done. But if that wasn't, it kind of just made things easier. But now we got MFA fatigue, where the attacker's going to try and get into here, and they're going to keep hitting you up and just really drive you nuts with all the alerts until you say, finally, yes, that was me. Here's the code. Yes, I'm trying to sign in, and so on. And once the adversary gets in, what are they really looking for in these clouds? cloud accounts, whether it be, you know, sensitive information, payroll, banking information, business critical processes. It really depends on whatever the adversary's goal is, right? If they're looking for the data, if they're looking to just gather a bunch of usernames and passwords, does that exist there? But I still think they feel like, or I feel like that the adversaries took advantage of everyone just rushing to the cloud. So they're like, you know what, if we're not going to have on-prem, yeah, we'll modify our processes and procedures as well. And the second one was email forwarding rule, or it was email collection, email forwarding rule, which is technique 11, or falls under technique 1114. So it's some technique 1114.003. And this covers, it jumped 31 spots up to number 6. So once again, getting access, and to get access to this, to the email accounts, it appears that they're using valid accounts again. So we're still in that line of, once they got access to the account, they sign into the email address, and how can they abuse the email service to collect information, to send stuff, you name it. But they were creating these new rules that would direct the mail that the adversary wanted to the junk box, to a different directory or a different folder that the legitimate user doesn't check a lot. And then there's even an ability to hide the rules, which blew my mind that you could create a hidden rule. But then again, you know, why not? And of course, my first mind was, all right, well, now whatever rule is created, how do we detect this? Is there an event log that will capture this? And the answer was no. Or at least my research, I couldn't find a solution to find even like an Outlook log that would say, hey, this rule was created and this is its purpose. So now you know, the SOC or whoever's monitoring the network is blind to it. The user may be blind to it because I don't know how many times you check your rules, to see if there's new ones there. But it was just an interesting way to redirect information to wherever they want. And I'm sure they could even email things out to themselves if they wanted. So they're collecting all this information, they're collecting the email itself, anything attached to it, and then just shipping it out away to the cert or to wherever they want so that they can continue their attack or collecting information or sell it. Now, saw this, thought of you. They always had some very creative rule names, which, can you guess what they are?
Yeah. Single character names?
Yes, single or double character
names. There you go. The lazy name.
Always. and it just it never stops, but yeah, it was just a good report. Now there's so much more in the report.
Oh yeah, there's a lot in this one.
Like the abridged version is 162 pages, but it's great. They provide a lot of other technical information. I just went straight to the techniques because that's what I do. But so let me ask you this: what chunk of the report did you check out?
So it's probably the top 50 pages or so. That's about as far as I got into it, because I got enough good things to talk about that I was like, all right, I don't have to read the whole thing. But yeah, I'll dive into some of the things that I saw that were really interesting. One was, I really liked how they did a pre-ransomware call out. Basically, you know, when people always focus on ransomware, it seems like the ransomware part is the part a lot of people talk to, or that's the part that, if you look at leadership in ransomware or leadership in companies in security, it seems like they always talk to like the fear of ransomware. They don't understand there's so much more involved. I mean, we didn't mention there was a 4-day, you know, operation time, but you know, they call it out initial access, lateral movement, recon, and exfiltration. All are usually precursors, right, before the ransomware. And then Something else they called out that they were seeing from initial access when it came to attachments or file drops. They, focused in on there's a lot of the zip, RAR, ISO, VHD files because of the lack of Mark of the Web. And then from within that, executions of .hta, .bat, .ps1, which are common techniques. Like they're saying they're seeing all this activity in 2023, right? Like I think you can go back to 2022 and 2021 and you would see similar things. Other than some of the initial access with the different compressions or image types that they're using. But then there was a note in there that I really liked. And they were talking about how there was some use of .js files like JavaScript. And they know that a lot of users don't need to execute JavaScript from a native file by any means. So one of the controls they mentioned, which I thought was ingenious, was, on the computer system, you can associate what file types get run by what. That's why when you double click on an EXE, it runs a certain way. That's why when you double click on a DocX for Microsoft Office, it opens with Microsoft Word. There's associations, right? That's kind of like pre-programmed in the registry, I think, to kind of make that work. And they're saying, why not just take non-necessary file types that your users should never really be interacting with, and associate them with Notepad? So they could try to open something, it opens a Notepad, nothing negative will happen because of that. And it's not that they can't be opened correctly, because you can right click open with and go down that mess if you really need to do something. But it would protect a lot of your users from opening file types that they normally wouldn't need to. It might be an interesting policy in general. So I thought that was a really good tip, trick, or whatever that they included. They did talk about transfer tools, or transferring tools as a, after initial access, which usually followed an exploit. And I thought this was good too because I saw a lot of this as well. But the very common use after an exploit occurred, the exploit wasn't really the thing that did the bad. It was the thing that got them access, but they still need to pull in whatever it is they wanted to run. And a lot of times it was either PowerShell pulling things down, surutil, or curl. So, I think that's a great thing when people worry about like, well, we don't know about 0 days or we don't know about these things. Well, focus on that next step that almost always has to happen. I think it's a great way to kind of cover your ground a little better and not have to know everything. So I like that call out. The other interesting thing I liked they mentioned was with reflective loading. And that's where they're basically calling a process in order to load something in it to run. And a lot of times you can call a process that is got a known good reputation to help get around other things. But they did something that I've looked at before as well, where they said it's good to know what system tools or executables run with or without command line, or like what kind of command line structure do they need to normally have. And the example they called out here was MS Build. Like MS Build is a utility in Windows almost every time has to have some sort of command line following it for it to run like it's supposed to run. And when people were using it for reflective loading, you would see the execution of it, but with no command lines at all. So kind of an interesting look at, well, what does or does not use command line? And that might be an interesting thing to look for in your environment once you kind of normalize what is normal and what's not. Especially when you're looking at system files specifically. So I thought that was another interesting technical call out. And then the one thing I really loved, and I don't really know how to take this, but they had their top 10, right, of their real world techniques. And then they had the graph of top test techniques. And it kind of just cracked me up because, the test techniques that they were saying were the top things that people test for were not in the real world techniques. It's a completely different list. And granted, I mean, the top real techniques when they have PowerShell or Windows Command Shell or Windows Management Instrumentation is the top three. Like, what do you test for that, you know, other than having visibility and, you know, that kind of thing? Because you can do a number of things with that. But it still kind of made me kind of chuckle. It's like, you know, how are we using this data effectively? And it seems like we're not, I guess. So maybe we should have a different or a better approach to that. So that was something that was kind of a takeaway was, you know, we have this great way to map things, great way to describe things, but still not a great way to validate and operationalize things. Yeah, I guess security people are always really good at writing about the problem than solving it in some cases. And I feel like there's like a miss there. Like I can't say that anyone's necessarily doing it wrong, or I hate offering up or calling things out when I don't have the best solution or a replacement solution. But it was just something it came to my attention, right? Looking at that. And then the last thing I really liked that they said was they had, you know, techniques by volume. Like, how often did you see them? And then they had the top techniques by industry. And there really wasn't a huge difference other than the OS credential dumping, which was listed, I think, in the volume, but not the frequency when it came to the industries, because it was ranked 11 and they did top 10. So it was close, just right there. And I think that says a lot, and that is, regardless of what unique techniques adversaries do, a lot of them are all still doing some of the same playbook, because they need to achieve the same thing in order to achieve their ultimate goals. And so the key takeaway they wrote in there, it says, from their analysis of technique abuse across industries, the adversaries reliably leverage the same small set of 10 to 20 techniques against organizations, regardless of the sector or industry. And this is why I have a hard time when people say, well, I want to know what's affecting the banking industry. I want to know what's affecting the energy industry. Or I'm only really worried about ICS. I'm not really worried about IT because IoT or OT is more important. And the thing people fail to realize is those techniques are common because they have to be. And there's nothing wrong, like, you don't, there is no prescribed, this is how you attack an energy company, because you can't tell me one sector only uses Windows and the other one only uses Mac and the other one only uses Linux, so their techniques and attacks are vastly different. No, we're all using the same technology, so the same techniques are going to apply. And I think it's a miss when people try to categorize, like, the data is always really interesting to look after the fact how things group and categorize, but I don't think that helps you strategically address the problem. So I loved that call out. I thought that was so true, because I've always believed that, and they have the data to support that, so it makes me feel better about my beliefs, whatever. But yeah, that was probably the last takeaway I had that I was pretty much like, yes, that made me feel good about what I do as a threat hunter, because that's kind of what we focus on. Like, obviously there's more than just the 20 techniques, but we do agree there's, you know, probably 10 to 20 things that you should do well and you'd be in a pretty good place.
So it's kind of like when you're talking about the data, it's kind of like saying that, yeah, what you're thinking is on the right track and it lines up with the data. So keep doing what you're doing and it's working.
Right.
Cool. All right. Well, now that we've put the 162-page report to rest, what you got?
So one of the things I wanted to hit on was HelpNet Security had an article, and I thought this was interesting. I forgot exactly what report or what their source was for this specifically, but it was titled "Medical Devices Cybersecurity Concern," and it kind of had a bunch of statistics. Like, for instance, it was like 63% of CISA track known exploited devices are on healthcare networks, and 23% have at least one known exploit. And, you know, 13% of those devices only support endpoint protection agents, but 72% of them communicate to the internet. And then they talked about how 22% of hospitals' devices are bridging the guest network with like real networks. And I thought this was interesting that one, they really were thought they were going to solve security by being able to put an endpoint device in all the devices, like endpoint protection. Because to me, when I even look at a security environment, that's not where my head goes right away. I'm not like, well, we just need to install security tools everywhere and it solves the problem. I care about, well, what kind of visibility do I have? What kind of protections do I have? What are my boundaries? Where, like, what can communicate to what? And that really comes back to architecture, you know, first and foremost. Because I think of medical devices too. I feel like it's medical devices are not something that you were like, oh, someone's connected to something that's doing a blood transfusion. Oh, it needs an update. Well, we can update it right now in the middle of this. Like, no. And then even if you updated it offline, you can't reliably say, well, we're going to have no issues with this because we don't want to accidentally kill anybody. That these things don't get maintained the same way, just like a lot of OT stuff doesn't get maintained the same way when things work. And because of that, you got to have better architecture and you got to have a little more stricter boundaries as far as like what can talk out and what can talk in. Or if you need to access something, not have, you know, have kind of like jump hosts that you can install really good monitoring on to access things. So there are technologies out there that really solve a lot of these problems, and a lot of planning that goes into it also solves these problems. You know, I've heard in healthcare, it's hard because, you know, if doctors mandate it because they're the ones that make the money, you just got to go with it. Well, every business is kind of mandated by what makes the money, but you also have to do a really good job explaining the concerns and find the technologies or the, you know, happy meet in the middle where the convenience is there enough, but you know, the security is there to say, well, now we're not at risk for the same things. So, yeah, I just thought it was an interesting article that kind of went down the path of not how I would solve the problem, so I wouldn't be scared the same way. But I thought it was noteworthy to say, yeah, I understand the state they're in, but I also think the solution is not what they're trying to drive it to be.
So, my mind went to the same place or similar place with the critical infrastructure. Like we hear this with like the water treatment plants. I think we talked about a while ago that they have like a but or it's a budget, right? It's a budget issue is that they don't have, or because it's a business to make money and it's a water treatment facility that's not sitting there and, you know, making a killing because it's, you know, like a major minor function. They really kind of just, not ignored it, but they don't have money to spend on the security devices that they need. I think you touched on the doctors mandating. I get it. Like, I don't know what's going on. Is it if it's a budget or if it's the old fear of doctors not being able to have access to what they need, or if it's the fear of restricting too much and people are going to die. I'm curious to see, and I wish I would have thought about this during the research, but I would have loved to see all the security, like best practices that were ignored. And, you know, how often did this lead to hospitals being attacked or ransomware? Because I think they said, what, that they found 22% of hospitals have connected devices that bridge guest networks?
Mm-mm.
Like,
yeah.
No. And if that was the case because someone was afraid that they won't be able to, and they were just like, push it over there, that kind of tells me that the people making the decisions don't understand the risk there. Like, yes, I get it. Hospitals, water treatment plants, critical infrastructure, that's mainly operation issues. But when you start just blatantly ignoring the things that the most basic cybersecurity thing happens or like recommend in lieu of operations, then that's where it becomes a problem. I want to go back and do that research to figure out, you know, if this is the case. In most hospital attacks, what has happened? What was the initial access? You know, find that vector and take a look at the decisions that led up to that. Now, granted, there's no way I can do that to every single hospital, but if someone has that data, that'd be great to see, because that could be the perfect use case that, you know, if you do it right, you can still be secure, but access everything you need. I just don't feel that with the technology and controls in place that we have, that's not possible.
Yeah, I mean, my dream idea of like all these different like sectors of infrastructure and things like that we rely on that are key. You know, we have national labs, we have ISACs. It'd be cool if some budget went towards a lab-like environment where they can say, here's the best possible way to set up the similar technologies you own the right way and what it looks like. Or if there's something you're trying to figure out to secure, we can provide, if you can provide the hardware, we can provide the network for you to do all your testing on to validate things, and we can test against it, right? And have other vendors in the same space, you know, test against it to say if they like it or not, right? I feel like, you know, that's something that we miss in a lot of those areas, that we have the right resources, we're just not working well enough together to determine what right looks like. Because you get a lot more support, right, when you have people outside of your group, and because there's nothing better than I like hearing is like, well, what's my competitor doing? Like, how do they run their environment? How do they set it up? And for some reason, if you find out that your top three competitors run it the way you want to run it, then your leadership's like, well, we better do it that way, you know? So that's kind of an advantage sometimes if you can like do things that way.
That'd be nice. That'd be like what worked and how can we mirror off of that? That'd be great.
Right. Like what's sometimes that's all people need is almost like a cheat sheet, right? Of what to do versus like guidelines. So yeah, that's all I had. Just kind of quick. It's interesting. I like to think about those types of problems and like how we'd solve them or think about them or what do they really mean. So what do you got?
So next up is a technical write-up by Sonic Wall, and they were talking about the interesting multi-stage StopCrypt ransomware variant propagating in the wild. A lot of heavy technical details, especially with the malware analysis side of things. Not going to walk through that. More on the tactics, techniques, and procedures perspective that I always find interesting. First up is their defensive evasion technique. I don't know who chose this number. Never mind. Or who chose the number. But they were having long time delaying loops. So 65 sec. What am I looking at? 1, 2, 3.
That's a big number.
Well, now that I'm looking at it again, the number doesn't make sense.
Then up at the commas in the right place.
I was going to say, maybe the commas are wrong. But it looks like it's supposed to be 651,840,312 iterations, where the same data is copied to a location and the count is incremented. So, like, that's just an absurd amount of time. Like, I feel like most sandboxes, the max you could do is like 15 minutes. I mean, of course, unless you build your own and have it dedicated to whatever case may be. But that's not like the only time that they saw that there's also reasons. There are other examples of that in the same malware. So it wasn't just this one time that it would wait 651 million seconds. Or 651 million copying and pasting. But it was also, the code was riddled with it too, which cracks me up because, I mean, at that point, like I question how long did that copy and paste take? Now, if it is like milliseconds, I get it. That starts to make sense because It's automated, so it's not manual, so you're not hitting there control C, control B. But that still seems like an absurd amount to really just get around defenses. Then, looking into the final payload actually executing, we see the normal things that or techniques. And I always like bringing these to light because it kind of shows the time-tested longevity of it. But we see scheduled tasks being used and other living off the land binaries being used to modify the system to gain persistence. We see the iCalcs.exe being used to deny permissions. So like now that it's persistent, it's modifying who can and cannot delete it. And then, the ransomware creates a scheduled task to execute a copy of itself. So not only are we seeing permissions, we're seeing scheduled tasks, and then malware co or creating a copy of itself somewhere else to once again possibly for defense evasiveness. But these are all the things that that really show time and time again that, yes, ransomware is big and scary, and you may have mentioned it in your pre-ransomware discussion. But that's what you need. These are the things you need to look for is you're always in trouble if you see the ransomware or if you detect on the ransomware. If that's your point of, oh no, something's happening, it's too late. But if you can start picking up on these behaviors of a file creating a file with a different name and the same hash in a different location, if you can pick up on that, then that's probably something, that's either anomalous, suspicious, or malicious. Or if you see scheduled tasks being created that run every 5 minutes or on log on or something outside of the norm of your environment, these are things that, it would help to pay attention to figure out what you're looking at and what something might be leading up to. So maybe detect on the scheduled task versus the ransomware itself. But I thought this article was great, great technical details, and that humongous defense evasion really cracked me up because I just pictured like what would that look like in Joe's sandbox. Like, would that just destroy it? I don't know. But what were your thoughts?
So I thought it was funny too, that loop to create or, large number of writes in the same file in the same location. Because I thought back in the day before people really knew how to handle ransomware or some of the other things ransomware was doing, the first thing I looked for were like system resources going up, a lot of file modifications or file writes because, things are being encrypted. So I thought it was weird they used that technique to, I guess, defense evasion, right? Delay execution, because they're doing an activity that ransomware is known to do already. Now, I don't know if people lean on that so much for identification anymore, but that was kind of ironic. But obviously, you can look for large swaths of file writes within a period of time to key on weird behavior like that. Obviously, this one is always interesting because it uses a lot of API calls for a lot of its activity. Which, in my mind is a little stealthier than your average binary or malicious file. But there are like things that stood out. Like the one thing I thought was interesting is when they used the iCalcs or ICALS, when they denied any modifications or deletions of their file, that's what they changed was the rule there. They applied that to everyone. So then afterwards, they couldn't even delete or do anything with that file. They basically locked that file out, which is also, I guess when you're doing ransomware, you don't care, but you're leaving your artifacts behind, significantly and preventing yourself from cleaning up. And then, scheduled tasks. That's, something that's very common. There's always common things to look for, even on sophisticated binaries. There's always a way. There's always something they do typically that you could at least key off of as long as you're looking for the right things. So that was something that stood out as well. But yeah, it was just kind of an interesting read to see. Like I would say, it's some really highly technical things mixed in with some lowbrow things and some weird things. You know, you can tell it's a bunch of things kind of combined together.
All right. So how are you going to take us home?
Yeah, so I'm going to take us home with something I normally don't like, you know, pride on talking about, and that's vulnerabilities. But I thought this was a little interesting. And, you know, for things to look for as well. So it was a Bleeping Computer article that talked about hackers exploit the AIO HTTP bug to find vulnerable networks. And basically it's CVE-2024-23334. It's a directory traversal. So it's not something that necessarily gets you access as far as, you know, you're running code, you're doing things, but it lets you access data. And what's interesting about this and why there might be some interest in this is the AIO HTTP Python library, which is what has this vulnerability, is a really async IO. And what it actually does is it lets them better manage large amounts of concurrent HTTP traffic. So, you know, either high performance web apps, or services that aggregate multiple external APIs. And a lot of times, a lot of development companies and things like that that have a lot of that interaction have this library. So there's a lot of potential intellectual property and things that could be of interest. But basically, how the vulnerability really works is there's a setting that basically says follow symlinks or not. And if it's set to true, it basically allows unauthorized access. And you don't necessarily have to follow the symlink. So it's associated with that, but the vulnerability it means is that's not even being applied correctly anyways, from the sounds of it. So basically, if I wanted to traverse outside of the public-facing web app root directory, I can say go to, say, etc password D, right, on your Linux server, and read the contents potentially of that. So if you have other files or things on the system, it kind of gives you access to be able to view, read, and you know, collect information. There might be interesting information that you don't want to expose, as well as information that could be used later to compromise you. And what's interesting is there's been a huge uptick. I guess the POC was published February 27th, and they started to see active exploitation February 29th. So like, you know, 2 days is pretty standard for things that may be easy to accomplish or worth putting time into, from turning, you know, POCs into actual full-on exploitation seen by adversaries. But they've been seeing it ramp up even, you know, to today, right, as far as they see this steady increase. And they actually tie a lot of the infrastructure that's basically identifying a lot of the public stuff exposed to the Shadow Syndicate. They're like a big player in exploiting and interacting with vulnerable targets. And tied to ransomware as well. So that, you know, obviously looking for new targets, big targets, things that have value that, you know, might be kind of part of the process. But, you know, it's just kind of an interesting, you know, application of what the vulnerability is, why it works the way it does. And, you know, it's something that people are fairly interested in. And I didn't see a lot of visibility outside of what I found here yet that's kind of bubbled up in other things that I follow. So I thought that was interesting as well. So yeah, just something easy. So what were your thoughts?
Well, I went through, and as I was reading it at first, I was like, well, hey, I don't see remote code execution here.
Right.
But then it got a little darker. Like you said, accessing different files. And of course the screenshot includes the Etsy password file. And you're just like, oh, okay, there it is. That's where.
Oh yeah. So that's what I wanted to bring up as far as looking for weird activity like this. Is if you have access to the logs and the locations people are going to on your web server, you should be looking for key terms like password D or Etsy, you know, like even full parts of the folder structure that you would never expect to see from your system in any kind of web request for directory traversal stuff. That'd be a good indicator to know that at least something's happening, but go ahead.
No, that like I was just surprised, right? Like, hey, that's good. That's not remote code execution. But yeah, it makes sense. And if they aren't looking for password, if they are looking for sensitive data, to kind of like hide in between, like if they don't want, if all of a sudden, you know, this is let out and everyone's like, let's look for the Etsy password. If they're working elsewhere, you know, because that might not be the only file that contains password information. Now, it should, but you know, you can possibly find it in like text documents, and so you know, you never know where you're gonna find a username or password. But yeah, and it's just like, man, like I thought it was gonna be an okay vulnerability. Not so much at the end. I could see how, and I think you mentioned this as well, proprietary information, bank statements, you name it. There could be a lot that you actually glean from this without even having to gain further access. If you can exploit this vulnerability, I mean, you might just get all the information you need without having to do any other work. And it's scary what it says. Version 3.92 and from 3.91 and older that allows unauthenticated remote attackers to access files. So, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that everything before 3.92?
Yeah, I think so.
Ugh. Now that I think that's a big deal as well. Like you mentioned, it's open source. So maybe people aren't updating it. Maybe they found a solution somewhere.
It's hard to just linked in somewhere too, right? It's kind of like, you know, Log4Shell.
Yeah.
Because you run into like, okay, you specifically put it into your web app or you built it and you want to use it, or you have a product that's potentially using it. That's a harder thing to address. This shouldn't be, but it's harder to know you have that problem.
Right. Right. And it is concerning, but still a very interesting read as always.
All right. So with that, you know, we have a couple announcements. One, you've got your Hunting for Initial Access workshop, which will be this Wednesday, March 20th from 12 to 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. We also have our live edition of podcasts happening April 4th from 7 to 8:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. So those are two really good events, very interactive. As far as you get to be with a Hunting for Initial Access, you get access to data. Lee gets to walk you through everything, show you some of his key highlights on doing so. And then obviously our live edition of this podcast, you get to interact and hopefully engage in some of the discussions we'll bring forth. And if anybody finds interesting things, for instance, on LinkedIn or elsewhere, you know, one of the things we're going to start doing is marking our content, but with a hashtag out of the woods podcast, all one word spelled out that way. And it'll help us find things that you find are interesting discussion topics. That way you don't have to like throw something directly our way, via comments and things. You can just, tag things and we'll take a look and decide to pull things in based on what we're going to talk about. We're going to try that ourselves. So you'll see the things we're looking at as well. There might be something interesting for you to follow maybe. But just be aware of that. And with that, I just want to thank everyone for joining our Out of the Woods Threat Hunting podcast today. Looking forward to syncing back up next week. And that will close out our top five threat hunting headlines for the week of March 18th, 2024.
Happy hunting, everyone.
Happy hunting.
Thanks for listening to the Out of the Woods podcast. Be sure to subscribe wherever you heard this podcast so you never miss an episode. For more information or to connect with Cyborg Security, check us out online at www.cyborgsecurity.com and follow us on social media. We'll see you next time.